is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the CDC is out with a list of causes of mortality in 2014. Heart disease still leading cause of death in this country.
And another statistic, Mark, that comes as no surprise, the number of drug-related deaths went up in 2014, 6.2% from the year before. Just under 50,000 Americans died from drug-related causes in 2014.
But it's still shocking to realize just how prevalent this issue has become. This is a complex issue to tackle.
Understanding and managing disease is something that our guest is very focused on. Larry Smarr is a renowned computer scientist who's decided to become the most quantified person in the world, taking a very deep dive into his own microbiome to understand every possible statistic related to his health. Very fascinating perspective, and we look forward to that. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Larry Smarr in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Obama administration has reiterated a commitment to combating the opioid crisis. White House drug czar Michael Botticelli, flanked by Health and Human Services Director Sylvia Burwell, outlined messages aimed at increasing the resources being made available to states battling the crisis on the home front. Among the measures being promoted, increasing the numbers of patients a clinician can treat for opioid addiction, making it possible for those patients to receive the replacement drug buprenorphine, which is itself a narcotic but doesn't create a high. Currently, an estimated 2.2 million Americans are suffering from opioid addiction. Only half received treatment in the past year. The president has also requested $1.9 billion to fight the Zika virus now manifesting on U.S. soil in the form of infants being exposed in utero, being born with a signature deformity of microcephaly. House and Senate committees have looked at different bills to address the problem. And the Senate, which passed a Zika funding bill during the filibuster on gun control, added so many so-called poison pills to the bill, Democrats voted it down. Their add-ons would have reduced funds for the Affordable Care Act and taken money away from Planned Parenthood. They're singing a happier tune in Louisiana these days, the 31st state to expand Medicaid coverage to more of its poorer residents under Obamacare. Though Louisiana ranks dead last in health outcomes in the country, previous governor Bobby Jindal refused to expand coverage to hundreds of thousands of the poor and uninsured in his state. Since Governor John Bel Edwards took office, tens of thousands have already signed up for coverage. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Larry Smarr, founding director of the California Institute of Telecommunication and Information Technology, called CalIT2, a UC San Diego, UC Irvine partnership. He holds the Harry E. Gruber Professorship in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at UCSD, Jacobs School of Engineering, an astrophysicist turned computer scientist. Dr. Smarr has contributed to major developments in many areas, including the internet, the web, and virtual reality technology. He's the founding director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications and chairs the National Science Foundation Advisory Committee on Cyber Infrastructure. Also served on the advisory council at the National Institute of Health. He earned his bachelor's and master's degree at the University of Missouri and his PhD at the University of Texas, Austin. Larry, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, my God, you've had such a fascinating career. You've moved your academic focus in the early 80s from astrophysics to the then nascent discipline of computer science. You've taken a fascination, though, in exploration of the cosmos in the new era of supercomputers. And you've decided to quantify and measure every physiological and genetic and biological aspect of your own body. You're using a variety of technologies to do that. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners this journey of scientific discovery and what led you there and what are you finding?
Well, my natural inclination is always to think of dynamic complex systems as something you have to look at over time. That's, you know, if we look into the sky, we watch how Things change with time in multiple wavelengths, and that's how we figure out that they're neutron stars or they're supernovas or whatever. And so I got into changing my body when I came to San Diego from the Midwest and realized that I didn't look like the rest of these people. I was like a typical American. I was overweight. And so I decided to get with the program. And in doing so, you have to figure out, well, am I making any progress? And so I wanted to find out, was I possibly able to measure in my blood things like inflammation and short chain fatty acid? And I figured as a scientist, I ought to be able to just measure it and find out how I was doing. And the trouble was, I'd go to the doctor and they'd say, well, we can't ask that for that test. It's preventive medicine. And I said, say what? Like, okay, that's how we used to do our cars, you know, like in the 50s. We waited until smoke came out from under the hood and then we said, uh-oh. Nowadays, we just use computers to measure time series of all the components in our car, all the vital signs, and we preventively go in. And then your car runs for a couple hundred thousand miles just fine. So I found out you could just go on the internet and get these kind of kits and go to the local Quest, and they'd take some blood and you'd get some data back. Well, once I began to do that, I realized, gee, there are all these other things I could be studying. I wonder what else might be wrong with me. And oddly enough, I found out that I had a autoimmune condition and was highly inflamed, and it turned out to be a form of Crohn's disease. I had no idea, because at that time, I was symptom-free. It was early. And then later, I did develop a really uncomfortable set of symptoms for a number of years.
Well, Larry, we think about personalized medicine a lot these days, and you gave a great TED Talk, Can You Coordinate the Dance of Your Body's 100 Trillion Microorganisms? But you note that the way healthcare is practiced today really has clinicians just staying on top of what we might think of as some of the basic metrics, heart rate and BMI and blood pressure. You say we're missing out on 99% of the essential health data. So help us understand, what have your own quantified self-experiments taught you about what we're missing in mainstream healthcare?
Well, fundamentally, we don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a sick care system. You wait until people are symptomatic, until it's clear that you've got the problem, like, say, pancreatic cancer, then survival rate's very small. So you first have to understand, if we're going to have a healthcare system, it's a radically different system than what we have today, and it will be completely disruptive of the current financial regulatory structure with insurance and hospitals and doctors and everything. You want a preventive approach where you have tests early and often to discover that you're beginning to get something that goes wrong that's easy to fix and low cost compared to the massive cost that you'll spend the rest of your life paying once you've really broken your body. And actually, some of the things you mentioned, like BMI, is a useful indicator. If you begin to get above, say, 25 for BMI, and you know that by 30 you're going to become obese, that's a pretty clear signal that you need to change something in your lifestyle. Sadly, we're finding out that because of the microbiome, microbes that are in your gut, on your skin, in your mouth, and so forth, they're 90% of the DNA-bearing cells in your body, and they have 99% of the genes that are on the DNA in your body. There's more genes by 100-fold in the microbes' DNA in your gut than there are in every one of your human cells. And yet, all that is outside of medicine, because until recently, you didn't have the capability of genetically sequencing these and understanding who was there. It's now a million times cheaper to sequence these microbes. So that means it's coming into what will become a possible healthcare system, where you actually can begin to look at your entire body and how the microbiome can amplify problems like obesity. It's not just what you eat, although that's a big part of it.
You know, so much of America's innovation has started in people's garage. So I always like to talk to people about infrastructure. And you've got a pretty damn nice garage there at Cal IT2. And you have access to the state-of-the-art diagnostics, 3D printing. But really, you have access to very brilliant and talented scientists. Talk to us a little bit about the team that you've assembled to sort of pull all this stuff together.
Well, for 30 years, my job has been to live in the future and understand what the exponentials are going to make possible for widespread consumer use. In 1988, when I was running the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois, I bought a Cray 2. It cost me $20 million.
Oh, my God.
And people said the same thing to me then. Well, gee, that's fine for you, Larry. You got a Cray 2. Today, we have a billion smartphones that are faster than the Cray 2.
Right. That's right.
And so, you know, what are you doing? Are you solving Einstein's equations for general relativity on your cell phone? No, you're playing Angry Birds. We have a very powerful supercomputer of a yesterday in each of our pockets.
Yep.
And so now imagine that hooked with sensors like the iWatch is doing at Apple and all of the Fitbit and other kind of things that are monitoring you. You're becoming wired just like your automobile has become wired with sensors with incredible processing power. And all of this is sending the data into the cloud. So that imagine that all these artificial intelligence things we hear about are going to be able to compare across hundreds of millions of people's data. That's where we're going. What we're trying to do at Cal IT2 is assemble that kind of world now. This is going to become routine in the next, I would say, 10 to 15 years. The sooner we can begin to understand what the implications are for changing our regulations, for the disruption that's going to take place economically by actually living this way, that is incredibly helpful to the society as a whole.
Well, it's hard to believe the human genome was mapped only in 2008. And now, as you pointed out, you can have your genome sequenced for about $1,000. And I think the president actually launched a microbiome project earlier this year. Vice President Biden's presiding over the National Cancer Moonshot Summit. We have the president's Precision Medicine Initiative. Maybe you could talk about a few of these larger efforts that are really seeking, as you are, to accelerate that scientific discovery in healthcare.
Well, it's, of course, rewarding to see what people thought I was a little bit crazy about 5 to 10 years ago becoming presidential national initiatives. When you become a presidential initiative, what that is it directs all the federal agencies to make a priority of what you just talked about, the Cancer Moonshot, the Microbiome Project, Precision Medicine, or the Brain Initiative, for instance. So, you know, people love to talk about me as being the most quantified person and all that. My days are over as a leader in that area. And just look at the two private sector activities, Lee Hood, who's made a company called Aerovial, and Craig Venter, who's made the Human Longevity Inc. These are beginning to do everything I've done, sequencing the human genome, sequencing the microbiome, and Craig intends to do 100,000 people a year. So the private sector is how you scale things in this country, and that's where I think we're going to see most of the major development.
We're speaking today with Larry Smarr, founding director of the California Institute of Telecommunications and Information Technology, Cal IT2, UC San Diego, UC Irvine Partnership. You know, one of the opportunities I've had over the years is to travel, meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I know that there's a group of neuroscientists who have been working with His Holiness on sort of the impact of meditation. And I'm wondering, you know, you've talked about the physical side of health. I'm wondering, talk to us a little bit about the impact on mindful meditation, on any work that you're doing on that.
Absolutely. We're deep into it. Ever since Descartes said there was a mind and a body, and
right,
they were different,
yeah,
that has been a real problem in Western civilization. Your mind is a part of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And so stress is not a psychological thing. It's a biochemical phenomenon. So meditation or stress reduction techniques are one of the four most important pillars for health, the other three being nutrition, exercise, and sleep, which is one of the most ignored areas of health we have. But here at Cal IT2, we actually have a meditation sessions at noon for the campus, and then we have developed an ability to monitor your pulse to look at what's called heart rate variation. And what that does is directly read out the difference between your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So meditation essentially brings the parasympathetic up into balance with the sympathetic, and you can measure this quantitatively. In fact, we've created a bliss buzzer.
I love it.
You wear it, and then as you learn more to be mindful during your regular working hours, and it buzzes so that you are self-aware that you have attained a relaxed state. So you can train yourself to spend more of your waking hours in a mindful state. This has huge positive implications for your future health.
That is great.
Well, I think we'll be talking to our HR department about the bliss buzzer. But, you know, in all seriousness, there's sort of two sides I'd be interested in your commenting on. One, you know, the concerns about what do you do about the things that you can't do much about and how much additional stress that adds to a person's psyche. As we begin to think about the kinds of testing you're describing, and is there opportunity there or a likelihood that those with resources will be able to maximize life expectancy and quality? I wonder if you'd like to comment on that.
One of the unexpected consequences of what seemed like a good thing to do, which is to have government subsidies to make more food available, has led to these massive agricultural efforts to do corn and wheat.
Right.
In 1970, the average American consumed about a pound a year of high fructose corn syrup. Today, it's about 50 pounds, but that's coincidentally over the same period as the obesity epidemic. We've got to get back to getting people to eat real food. And you're seeing a great rise now in urban gardens. And
sure.
In fact, in some of the most blighted communities, to make the availability, particularly of fresh vegetables, to get away from antibiotics. 80% of the antibiotics in this country are used to fatten farm animals. And that affects your microbiome. So come back to another thing you're talking about. You know, a lot of people say, do I really want to know I'm going to have Alzheimer's or I'm going to have MS or something? What we're finding is that there are, in fact, lots of things you can do to stave off the onset of Alzheimer's, even if you are genetically predisposed to it. Food, exercise, sleep, mental activity, social involvement, all these things are now being shown, and maybe as much as decades later that you actually contract it. So you can do something about it. The microbiome has a big impact on a number of neurodegenerative diseases like MS, and there may be ways to help in some of these what were thought to be inevitable diseases you were doomed to. And I think over the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see things turn around in a lot of these supposedly hopeless, particularly neurological diseases, but also a lot of the ones that are more metabolic, metabolic syndrome and diabetes and obesity.
You know, Larry, the cost of healthcare has been a crippling reality in this country. And the latest estimate is that we spend about $3.5 trillion per year on healthcare, which it's estimated about a third of that is simply wasted, unnecessary care, or worse, the wrong care. And we are not getting great outcomes. I'm wondering, as you sort of think about the work that you're doing, how do you think it's going to impact the cost and, more importantly, on the outcomes?
Having been through a number of these major disruptions, after the disruption, the world looks completely different and is organized totally differently.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to get there by incrementally rearranging the chairs on
the sinking Titanic.
I mean, that's not the way we're going. It's going to be radical shifts, and one of the most radical shifts is for us to undo 50 to 100 years of propaganda that says you shouldn't take any responsibility for your own body. Leave that to the doctors. That's just out-and-out guild protection by the doctors. The only person who is going to be able to keep you healthy is you. But all of these new technologies are allowing individuals to have input to change their lifestyle. It's estimated that roughly two-thirds of chronic diseases are essentially self-inflicted by lifestyle choices. 80% of the healthcare dollar goes to people with chronic disease. If you could use these technologies and this new individual responsibility and preventive and precision medicine to get rid of two-thirds of the chronic disease, you're talking a very large number. That's the hope. You couldn't possibly afford the automobile fleet that this country has in the hands of individuals without the revolution in sensors and feedback that the cars have had in preventive maintenance. So I think we're going to have to go through something like that. And there are going to be major winners and losers, and the losers, typically in these disruptions, do everything they can do. They currently own the field. They have the money for the lobbyists. They can, you know, change the regulations. They can control Congress and laws. But once things start to crumble, and the new world begins to develop, as you're seeing, as I said, Lee Hood and Craig Venter lead the way, and with Erival and Human Longevity, the snowball is going to grow and grow and grow, and it is going to drive the disruption from this current sick care system we have to a true health care system. And I hope to live long enough to see that transition.
Well, I hope so, too. And I think you are going to continue to be a pioneer. We've been speaking today with Larry Smarr, founding director of the California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology at UC San Diego and UC Irvine. You can learn more about his work by going to lsmarr.calit2.net or follow him on Twitter at lsmarr.larry. Larry, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Libertarian presidential nominee Gary Johnson wrongly claimed that, quote, no politicians outside of Bernie Sanders and myself support legalizing marijuana at the congressional, gubernatorial, senatorial level. In fact, there are at least 20 other members of Congress and one governor who support the legalization of marijuana. Johnson, a former governor of New Mexico, made the claim in talking about his efforts to appeal to young voters who supported Democratic presidential candidate Sanders. In 2015, Sanders introduced a bill that would remove marijuana from the list of federally controlled substances and repeal federal penalties for growing, possessing, or using it. States would be allowed to impose their own restrictions, which is a proposal Johnson supported when he ran for president 4 years ago. Sanders' bill has no co-sponsors, but a similar one in the House has 18 co-sponsors. Also, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley supported a successful ballot measure to legalize marijuana for recreational use in his home state of Oregon in 2014. Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin of Vermont outlined a legalization plan for his state in January. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's no secret that baby boomers are aging in large numbers. 4 million Americans live with Alzheimer's disease, and we know that number will double by 2025. Daniel Cohen has devised a tool that is improving the experience for these patients whose quality of life declines along with the loss of brain function. He wondered, what will happen if you provide iPods for patients in nursing homes that are loaded with their own personal playlist of the songs they loved when they were younger? In his first pilot program called Music and Memory, patients in a nursing home were given the iPods with their own personalized song list, and the results instantly noticeable. Patients went from being non-communicative and disengaged to being animated and engaged. Patients like Henry, featured in this documentary on the program called Alive Inside.
What was your favorite music when you were young?
I guess Cab Calloway was my number one band guy I liked.
What's your favorite Cab Calloway song?
Oh, I'll be home there for Christmas. You can count and plan.
Cohen explains one of the theories as to why this program works so well.
Because our memories of music are co-located in the brain with our autobiographical memories. When you play a song that's familiar, you're kicking off memories that you had.
The results from the Music and Memory program were so impressive that Cohen's personalized iPod program is now being used in nursing homes throughout North America.
The feedback from the front line, from the nursing homes and from the staff, is that their ability to provide care is facilitated. And so that allows them to get their job done, to pay attention to all the residents as much as possible.
A simple, personalized application for a readily available piece of technology that could dramatically impact the quality of dementia patients' lives. Oh, that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.